afternoon, everybody. Welcome to the Senate Committee on Healthcare and Human Services. It's Monday, May 20th. And we only have a few bills. And colleagues, you'll notice that we have an informational meeting at the end. There are a couple of bills that have been sent down to Ways and Means, and I know that Senator Steiner Hayward will see these bills, but I thought it was good would be good for us to see what the House sent on mental health housing, and so that's why I schedule it for this committee so that they can share that information with us. Sandy, are we ready for this? We have the paperwork and everything?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 2101B.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2101B consolidates several provisions relating to the Oregon Health Licensing Agency, authority over certificates, permits, licenses, and registrations and fees collected for those documents. This bill is not a fee bill. You'll recall that last week when we scheduled it for a work session, we had a conflict amendment with the previous bill that the governor's already signed, House Bill 2102. We do have the paperwork for that right now, Madam Chair. Minimal fiscal impact and a no revenue impact.
And those are the B5s?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Okay, we're in work session. Senator Steiner Hayward?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, I move that the B-B5 amendments be dated 5/13/13 be incorporated into House Bill 2101.
Senator Steiner Hayward moves that the amendment B-5 be moved adopted into House Bill 2101. Is there any discussion? Any opposition? So ordered.
Madam Chair, I move that House Bill 2101 as amended be sent to the floor with a due pass as amended recommendation.
All right. Senator Steiner Hayward moves House Bill 2101 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Clerk will call the roll.
Aye.
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 Vice
Chair Cruz. Excused. Aye. Motion carries. Is anyone craving to move this or carry this bill?
Either Shields or me, I don't care.
Oh, Senator Shields?
Sure.
Fine.
Okay. Senator Shields will carry the bill, and I will close the work session on House Bill 2101B and open a public hearing on HJM 14. Representative Buckley, are you...
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committees. I'm Representative Peter Buckley, representing South Jackson County in the legislature. Thank you for your time and consideration of this measure before you. It came to me from a group of folks who have been working in the healthcare field for a number of years, and they just want to express their frustration that we have not been able to get Congress to act in a way that would allow Congress to negotiate prescription drug prices that would save money for the federal government and the state government. And for all of us with our health care costs. A simple measure, and I appreciate your time and consideration.
You know, I'm really glad that you brought this forward. I mean, I was talking to some people who are very knowledgeable about drugs and cost of prescriptions in Europe. And I was saying, well, aren't they going to have a problem with this? And they say, hey, we regulate the price of drugs in Europe. We don't have the problem that you have in the U.S., and I had no idea. Any other discussion? Yes, Senator Cruz.
Yeah, Representative Buckley, good to see you.
Thanks, sir.
We're going to have another conversation, you and I, on an entirely different matter soon.
But, I am not afraid, Senator.
My question is, since Medicare doesn't really have control of the formula and their plans, how are savings going to be achieved?
Madam Chair, Senator Cruz, similar to the Veterans Administration, is my understanding that they are able to negotiate prices for their participants in the VA program. This would allow the federal government to do the same thing for the other programs, and I bet Senator Steiner Hayward will add on to that or correct me if I'm wrong.
Senator Steiner Hayward.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm going to add on, Representative Buckley, because what you said is true. The one difference here is that because Medicare recipients can fill their prescriptions anywhere and VA benefit recipients fill their prescriptions at VA pharmacies, this will be more similar to the Oregon program, the Oregon drug program, where people can get cards and Oregon negotiates prices for a specific formulary, and then people who are who have that card, you know, to be able to buy medications at a discounted price. My understanding is that this would work in that way as well. And I think this is a very timely memorial, Representative Buckley, because I just heard on the radio this morning a whole report about how Medicare Part D is very complicated, completely lacks transparency, and it's questionable whether it's really saving seniors money, and it's certainly not saving the federal government any money. So if we're buying these many drugs, then I think it's more than reasonable that we'd be able to have some negotiating power. I'm really glad to see this.
Just curiosity, I'm going to support the bill. Would we be better off if Congress allowed the state to do the negotiation?
Because Medicare is a federal benefit.
I don't think
we can do that. We do it as a state for other ones with Oregon, with Washington.
Right. I mean, if they're going to change the law, they could say, okay. I mean, just a thought. As cumbersome as state policy is, it's not nearly as cumbersome as federal policy. So just something, Representative, to think in the future, that maybe that might be something that we consider as something for a waiver request to allow.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Thank you, Senator.
Any other discussion? Thank you. Thank you, Representative Buckley. I will close the public hearing on HJM 14. And do we have all? Okay. I will open a work session on HJM 14.
Madam Chair, I move HJM 14 to the Senate floor with a do adopt recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves HJM 14 to the floor with a do adopt recommendation. Is there any discussion? Clerk will call the roll.
Aye.
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 Aye. Motion carries, and Senator Cruz will carry the bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I will make the point that maybe we ought to be looking outside the box on this as well.
Absolutely. I agree. Any way we can do this is good.
Are we ready to go here? Do we want to suspend it so you can vote on this one?
Okay,
he don't care. Okay. All right, I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2128. Sandy.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2128 requires the Oregon Health Insurance Exchange, otherwise known as Cover Oregon, and the Oregon Educators Benefit Board to reach an agreement on plans offered through the exchange for educators. Requires all OEB-offered plans be underwritten based upon the risk pool of eligible school districts and employees within those districts. This has no revenue, minimal impact statement. Madam Chair, left the House floor with 31 ayes, 25 nays, and I believe in your packet you have an A2 amendment. However, that's not complete, and they will explain.
Justin Black.
Chair Modest Anderson, members of the committee, my name is Justin Black from the Oregon Education Association. Yes, there will be a dash A3. Just to kind of, for some background, when the original exchange bill, or the bill passed, when the original bill that created the exchange passed, it allowed districts to buy into the exchange starting in 2015, but it didn't set some parameters on how that would be operationalized. So the intent in House Bill 2128 is to operationalize that. And the dash three is some work we've done with the governor's office to really make sure that it's clear what we're trying to achieve here. And the first is that the exchange has to be informed by stakeholders like school employees, school board members, school districts, and the Oregon Educator Benefit Board when they're designing these plans. And then number two, that the risk pool that districts are in stays together. What we're trying to achieve is some stability for school districts by keeping the risk pool large so that we don't just have a case of districts with low risk going through the exchange or OEB and creating some price difference just based on risk, which comes down to age and what's going on in the district. So this keeps one stable risk pool together. The other part that the amendment will do is set a process for OEB and the exchange to create rules to make that possible and to make the plans comparable between the two so the districts really know what they're buying when they're looking at plans. And that's the basic gist of the bill.
Can you go into a little bit more with what was the A2s that got in stuff?
No. It is basically, you know, I think The original 2128 that passed, it's the same intent.
Okay.
I think there's some clarity around language that we've come to with the governor's office to make it more succinct and make it work better for the exchange and school districts.
I just need a little more clarification when you say that any plan has to be underwritten by an insurer using a single risk pool composed of all eligible employees. Explain exactly what that
sure.
means.
So currently in OEB, you have one giant risk pool that has all school districts. Our goal is to keep that risk pool together, whether it's being purchased through the exchange or OEB, but that the general risk pool stay together. Our concern was is that there would be some districts with, say, a younger population, or districts that were in the metro area who generally have access to less expensive care because they're in the metro area, break off from the rest of the pool and kind of get artificially low rates, and we watch then the rest of the pool rates rise. This, by keeping everybody together, keeps more stability for all districts.
So if a school district mm-hmm. wants to go to the exchange, mm-hmm. you're saying the pool would have to stay the same, the whole pool would be the same, that's in the exchange will also would be considered part of the pool.
But all the offerings in the exchange are the same inside and out, so that's very similar to that as the exchange is currently crafted.
Yes, Senator Steiner here.
Can I just help explain this a little bit more, if I might, Mr. Black and Madam Chair? So the original language that was passed around the exchange said that starting with the 2015 plan year, that school districts within OEB could opt to go into the exchange and get all their insurance in the exchange. Right, and then OEB would continue as long as there were enough districts still in it to create some kind of a viable pool. And in general, I personally thought that was a good idea, but I had the concern that Mr. Black is outlining here, which is to say that, and oh, let me make one other point. The language was very clear that the OEB districts would represent a separate pool from the rest of the exchange, and they would be underwritten separately.
Mm-hmm.
So they're not going into the exchange in the way we would think about it, the way if I had a business with 10 employees, I would go into this big risk pool over here with the exchange as it's currently constructed.
Mm-hmm.
They would go into a separate risk pool over here. And if it's only three very small school districts that choose to go in, that risk pool would be quite small, which might or might not be very good for them if they had very young employees and were in a relatively urbanized area. Of course, you don't have small districts there. But the problem is what would happen to the rest. So the OEB pool would get unbalanced. And so the amendments to this will allow, that the changes in this bill will allow it for these three small districts, for example, to still be part of this large pool.
That's what I was asking, and that's what you explained. Yeah.
Chair Monica Anderson, Senator Steiner Hayward explains it much better than I do.
but Madam Chair, it is very similar to any insurer that's offering a policy in the exchange has to offer the same policy outside the exchange. So we're seeing the pools in more than one context being in and out.
Yeah. Right, exactly.
Mm-hmm. That's great.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Senator Knopf.
What happened to the task force in OEB that was supposed to... You're going to answer this question too?
I chaired it.
All right.
With all due respect, Mr. Black.
Please.
So that task force that was established in 2007,
yes.
with the and Sandy was the administrator who helped with this task force. You correct me if I get something wrong. Was established and was never constituted until late August of 2012. And the only provision in the legislative language was a task force would be established to determine whether the establishment of OEB has resulted in cost savings for the state. So the problem is, when you look at medical economics, that there are a lot of different ways to define cost savings. And I even went back to Ryan Decker, who had put that in 2007. He couldn't tell me what he meant. sorry, Ryan, if you're listening. So we got together a really great group, I think, with John McConnell, who's a great health economist from OHSU, and Mitch Greenlick and me for the legislative representatives and a member from a district that's in OEB and a member from a district that's not in OEB and somebody from the insurance from Pacific Source, I think. So it was a very diverse group of people. And we had some really great conversations about what did we really mean about cost savings. And some great witnesses who came and talked to us about the pros and cons both ways. And it became clear that because we hadn't collected baseline data before OEB was established, and those data would be very hard to get retrospectively, and because defining cost savings includes looking at things like not just cost savings to the state, but are we cost shifting onto employees, and because all of those things are bargained individually by district, that you could see a district where, for example, the agreement was we're going to pay you more salary and less in benefits, and that's going to look as if the employees are picking up more on the cost and it's being shifted, but in fact they're choosing to get more, and you see what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. So we went through this in a great amount of detail, and then we had some conversations about whether we wanted to reauthorize it and do a prospective study to look at what happens to OEB when they come into the exchange and develop a control population, and that turned out to be a $500,000 study. And we decided that as much as we'd like to know, ultimately it's kind of a moot point, and that it wasn't a good use of state resources to spend that kind of money studying this. So we had hoped that we would get some useful information, but unfortunately we weren't able to do a range of circumstances. What? Yes. Oh, and it sunsetted January 1st of this year.
So you mean you could have just said that?
That, yes.
But I want you to understand that we've taken it seriously, or at least I took it seriously when I ended up chairing the darn thing.
You clearly did.
I did. I tried very hard, didn't I, Mr. Black?
Yes.
These are good. Okay, good. So we tried, didn't get anywhere, and we all came to the agreement that it wasn't worth pursuing further.
Madam Chair, just to add on to that, at that point in time when we created OEB, many of us were looking for some baseline data on the front end of that, and we never got there either. So baseline data seems to be something we are incapable of establishing. And
well, I will say that I've had some conversations with Mr. King from the exchange, mm-hmm. and with other people who are interested in this, and they're having some very serious conversations with John McConnell and his associates at OHSU to actually establish this for the exchange and to do prospective data collection and analysis and get baseline health data on people coming into the exchange, stratified by their insurance status and things like that. So I'm hopeful that we'll be able to get some useful data this time.
But and hopefully we can, Madam Chair, and Senator Steiner Hayward has nothing to do with this bill.
No, it doesn't. But Senator Knope asked the question, and it was an interesting question.
So for the question, though, the way this is structured, with OEB being its own pool, does that create an uneven playing field for other insurers who are in the exchange then?
Madam Chair, no. It is an entirely separate risk pool.
Well, and OEB has multiple plans, and they don't just contract with one insurance company.
Yeah.
We should let the witness in.
Chair Montes Anderson.
Okay. Oh, that's right. Committee. You're here.
First of all, let me thank you for the most unique testifying experience I have ever had.
We're trying. It's the middle of May, Mr. Black.
But the general way it works is, much like PEB, OEB goes out for an RFP, every few years. They have multiple carriers involved. It's such a large pool. Originally, OEB started off with ODS, Kaiser, and Providence. I think they're now down to ODS and Kaiser, and then multiple dental as well, and life insurance and all that.
Madam Chair, I would suggest in the exchange in and of itself, at some point in time, there will be probably the bringing together of risk pools, but that is clearly a ways down the road.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, we'll wait for the amendment. And
is it possible to carry it over to Thursday?
We've already scheduled it for next Tuesday, the 28th, in anticipation. So it's already on the books.
All right.
Thank you.
Because I would like to be done by Tuesday the 28th, so we don't have to meet on the 30th.
Are you tired of us?
Yes.
Okay.
That looks very doable, Madam Chair.
I will close the public hearing on House Bill 2128A. And colleagues, we're now going to have an information hearing on House Bill 3332. And as I said earlier, there are some bills that the House sent down to Ways and Means that we really don't know much about. And so I thought it would be nice to just have a short informational hearing on House Bill 3332. And with that, it's, who wants to start? Chris, Clarissa, and Kevin McChesney, I guess. You probably know what order you'd like to go. Yeah. Yeah, I opened an informational meeting on mental health housing, HB 3332.
Chair Mona Sanderson, members of the committee, I'm Chris Bonneff. I'm executive director for the state chapter of the National Alliance on Mental Illness. We brought together the group that ultimately conceived the legislation, House Bill 3332. I'll briefly explain how it came about and what its intended purpose is. And then we have some NAMI members here kind of representing the lifespan of different stages of where housing is rather important as a cornerstone of recovery. The bill came about as an organization, like many working in mental health as advocates, during what have been relatively rough economic times. It feels like we've been scrambling for table scraps. And with health reform well underway, with the economy seeming to be stabilized and on the uptick, we felt like it was time to really look at our mental health system again and be proactive about where we could push some improvements in the system. So over the summer, we brought together a group of folks that, frankly, we just thought were very progressive, out-of-the-box thinkers that represented agencies from across Oregon that included people with CCOs, hospital systems, residential providers. You'll hear from Mr. McChesney in a minute. He was part of that work group, the people who were going to be responsible for building housing. And we sat down and kind of looked at the system and said, what do we really need out of this? As health reform is moving, where is it that we can do something tangible, something proactive, and something relatively simple that we think would improve the system? And the group quickly settled around housing. By and large, there is not a lot of movement, particularly in our adult mental health system, because we lack housing. So you get access, say, to Oregon State Hospital, and it's hard to step down because there's not the type of treatment housing available for you to step down to. Same thing in hospitalization. If you are in acute hospitalization, you will spend more time than is necessary in the emergency room and in acute psychiatric care because there's not the longer-term care, say, at state hospital level to access. If you're in treatment residential housing, it's hard to get down to semi-independent housing or supported housing because we don't have it or enough of it. So quickly, all these constituencies settled on housing, and then it was a matter of what do we do about that? And we looked at several criteria. Certainly, anything we proposed, we wanted it to mesh nicely with what was going on at the local level through the coordinated care organization systems and through reforms with our counties as their functions with as local mental health authorities. We also were very cognizant that the state of Oregon was on the verge of signing an agreement with the U.S. Department of Justice over the treatment and housing status of adults with mental illness here in the state of Oregon. And we wanted to make sure that whatever we did helped the state meet its obligations that it's going to have. We're in the first year of that four-year agreement. And by year three, the state is going to have to demonstrate improvement in housing for adults with mental illness. And so we wanted something that was going to help the state particularly meet its obligations with the federal government. And so with all that, we came down to running numbers, figuring out how is it, if we need housing in the broadest sense of terms, we need high-end treatment housing all the way to independent, semi-independent housing with supports. How is it that a project like that comes about? And so we sat down with the people who build those things and penciled out the numbers. And without one of the tenets was whatever we came up with, the state couldn't be asked to pay the full freight. It had to be something that leveraged investment in the communities and the local communities because, again, in the past, before CCOs, any type of residential housing we had was managed by the state. The state contracted for it. The state paid for it. You got access through it through the state. Well, under the new system, that's not going to be the case. The resources have to be locally based, so it's not going to be acceptable anymore, generally, that if you live east of the Cascades, we're going to send you to Southern Oregon because we have an open bed there. The idea is that if you live east of the Cascades, you should be able to access particular services east of the Cascades. So with all that, we came up with House Bill 3332. It's a specialized fund in which the state makes some type of deposit into it, and it's used to pay 20% of the cost of construction for new housing. And again, housing with the broadest sense of the word. And once you have that 20% investment, the people who build these, someone like Mr. McChesney's agency and the agencies he represents as the Providers Association, are able to collect the financing elsewhere to bring a project to fruition. And again, we purposely left housing as a broad sense because each community's needs, particularly as this evolves, are going to be different. There are going to be some communities, just by nature of the way the state managed resources, that will have an excess of residential treatment beds as compared to supported housing. And there's going to be some communities that have what they feel like enough supported housing but may need a respite center, for example. And so, you know, long explanation to a short concept, which is it's an investment fund. The beauty of it is that for every dollar the state puts in it, you're leveraging $4 from elsewhere out in the private sector or other types of housing funds that are available for these type of projects. And we do, you know, in conclusion, we feel like we're on to a good concept. I mean, you come up with something, you sit in your little mental health advocacy world, the mental health world, and you think maybe you've solved a small problem, and you propose something, and somebody thinks it's a good idea, and suddenly we're fielding calls from affordable housing and all different kinds of sectors that work on housing, wondering how we came up with this concept and saying this may be a model for us as we undergo dramatic change in affordable housing in the state. So we feel like we've come up with a model that's very viable. And again, we'll leverage what will be a relatively small investment. We'll leverage it into a large investment of permanent infrastructure and housing. With that, thank you very much, and I'm pleased to have some of our NAMI members then share their stories.
Thank you very much for having an information meeting on this bill. My name is John Rupp, and I'm an active member of NAMI. I'm a citizen of Salem here, and my story, I'm just going to briefly give over the last 5 years, I believe, is why a bill like this should pass for people that don't have these services. 5 years ago, I was diagnosed with mental illness. I had a mental breakdown. It explained to me a lot of things that happened over 25 years of my life before that I couldn't understand why I made such irrational decisions and had major depression. When I had my breakdown, I lost everything. I was practically on the street, didn't have a job or a home. I had ruined and sabotaged some of my personal relationships with family and friends. I was provided at the time a psychiatrist that was working with a local community program that gave me 6 months of housing and to try to help me get my feet back on the ground. And I was one of the very fortunate few people that got an opportunity like this. And what I can say now, I'll just go to the present time in the last 4.5 years since medications were figured out that worked for me. I've become very back to stability again, active member of the community. My family and friend relationships have been restored, most of them, which is kind of a miracle to me after what I did to destroy them. And it's all because I had that opportunity to have logistical support for about a 6-month period, the housing, and then they provided some other services and got me in touch with other state and local community services to help me get my feet back on the ground. So thank you for having us share today.
Oh, thank you, and thank you for sharing your story. I find this such an important aspect of wraparound services in treating people, because look what happened to you. I mean, you're back to leading a productive life.
Yeah.
Good afternoon. My name is David Forker, and I am here today to share my story with you and ask you to support the development of a special fund for housing for individuals with mental illness. I was in the foster care system as a ward of the court from January 2007 to December 2012. During that time, I spent about 5 years in a residential treatment, 2 years of which was in a locked facility. My last day in residential treatment led to my ability to seek my own apartment using the subsidy housing funds from the state. I found an apartment online and began moving towards becoming an independent adult. Although DHS was still a part of my life for the first 6 months of living independently, I was free to fully immerse myself in advocacy for youth and young adults living with mental illness, former and current foster youth and homeless youth and young adults, as well as attending Portland Community College with a 3.61 grade point average and transitioning to be an adult and actively participating in my community. Becoming involved in these things, I started to become successful, and I wanted to help others become successful as well. I had a plan, more than enough motivation, and more friends than I've ever had in my life, and as becoming a person that I finally could accept, and that acceptance had been long forgotten during my attempts to battle some of my own challenges previously. As with all young adults transitioning to be independent, problems started surfacing due to limited financial means and limited community support. These challenges and dealing with other challenges associated with adulthood led to my having to stop some of my advocacy. Eventually, I had to drop out of all my classes at Portland Community College because I was overwhelmed and depressed. When I dropped out of school, I lost my housing subsidy funding because I was not a full-time student nor had a full-time job. I went from a successful young adult to having no money, food, and ultimately homeless. I could not get food assistance or disability because I did not have an address or a phone number. And during this time, I experienced a lot of trauma. I did not feel comfortable or feel confident or independent. And I wanted to work my way back to where I was and start working towards my goals again, but I wasn't sure where to begin. I was struggling with homelessness, and due to attention deficit hyperactivity disorder and post-traumatic stress disorder, I experienced an inability to even meet my basic needs. Not having a home is physically taxing in a way that I could have never understood beforehand. Eventually, I was able to connect to an organization that provided me with assistance with resources, and I was able to begin putting my life back together. Because of this support, I was able to get food stamps and stable housing. Because I have stable housing, I am working to re-enroll in school and begin helping my community through advocacy again. I am a young adult with motivation and intelligence and a lot to offer others. I live with mental illness, but that does not limit the greatness I can achieve. In order to achieve my goals, all roads lead to having one of the most basic needs met, which is housing. There are many members of my community and other communities that have a quality of life beyond what others understand and expect. And that's why I need to have a safe, dry place in order to begin the journey to achieve my dreams. And I'm asking you to support the development of a special fund for housing for individuals with mental illness and for individuals like me. Thank you for listening to my story.
Thank you. Thank you so much for sharing that. And best wishes to you. Good luck.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to provide testimony today in the support of the creation of a housing development fund. I am a parent of 6 children, several of them.
Say your name.
My name is Clarissa McGee. I am a parent of 6 children, several of them with mental health issues. 2 of my children have what is considered to be severe and persistent mental illness. Such labels as attention deficit, post-traumatic stress disorder, major depression with psychotic features and even autism spectrum disorder have been given. My daughter's first hospitalization came at the age of 8 when the voices she was hearing told her to stay in the middle of traffic and get hit by a car. She has since been hospitalized 7 more times in the space of 7 years. 2 of those years were spent in residential treatment. She is now 14 and currently lives in treatment foster care. My son has been hospitalized 4 times and in residential treatment as well as treatment foster care. He is now 13 and living at home. The last 7 years has been a rough and tumultuous time in our lives. As I look forward to the future, I wonder what kind of lives will they lead. The statistics show that the odds are stacked against them. As parents, we are preparing our teenagers to transition out of the home, to get a job, to graduate, to drive, and eventually move out on their own, to one day have a home of their own. That is the dream of every parent, one that most parents will see come to fruition, that and more. I understand that children like mine will need professional support to be able to accomplish the same thing that others their age will do with ease. They will need that support to become productive members of society. Both of my children are very intelligent, compassionate, and talented in their own unique ways. They have dreams they want to achieve in life that start with their desire to live independently like their peers will. With the stability and help that supported housing provides, they will be able to one day lead productive lives and in all probability reach out and give back to others that are just like them. House Bill 3332 isn't just about today. We need to be thinking long term. This bill is something that will have an impact on their future. I am looking forward to their adulthood. I, as every parent, want my children to be a success, whatever that success may look like. Thank you.
Now, has this bill been heard yet in Ways and Means?
Not in Ways and Means, no.
I thought we heard it last week.
What?
We heard something very much like this. I'm on that, so I thought we heard it. Maybe I'm wrong.
Yeah, no, it hasn't been heard yet.
Sorry.
I thought
we heard something very much.
I see people shaking their heads.
Yeah,
in the back.
Okay, good, because okay. you hate to be that unaware of what's going on.
I apologize. We heard something analogous about leveraging. Okay. Sorry, apologies.
Well, mental health issues is a very high priority for many in the legislature, and I think that there's been just so much more bills. I just hope we can produce something effective, but I know with the Senate president, it's an extremely high priority for him, so I'm hoping.
Madam Chair, yes, there are large aspirations. It's a very large system that does need to get larger, and again, why we favor this legislation is because we wanted to really go after something targeted and concrete that we knew would help multiple layers of the system. And as was exemplified, housing, if you don't have housing, you can't introduce services, you can't introduce stability. And you need to have the different arrays of housing because everybody's needs at any given point in time are vastly different. And so that's, again, you know, we hope we've come up with something very simple conceptually that will have a profound impact for different aspects of the system.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Kevin McChesney.
Chair Mona Sanderson, members of the committee, thank you for listening to me today. I'm Kevin McChesney and represent the Oregon Residential Providers Association, otherwise known as ORPA, and we did collaborate with NAMI on this particular bill. We also feel it's very important that there be sufficient funding for housing. And really like the element of this that uses a small amount of state dollars to leverage private investment in housing. The other thing that's really important is Oregon has invested over the years a lot of money in licensed and secure residential services. And it's really left a a housing gap at the bottom of the continuum of services. And so we do find very frequently that we keep people in residential services longer than they need to be there for the benefits provided, because there simply is no other place for them to go. I also know that in the metropolitan area, it's not uncommon to discharge people from the state hospital to a motel, which you know, clearly is not an ideal housing situation. The organization that I work for, Telecare, operates the Crisis Assessment and Treatment Center, and it's not unusual for us to discharge people to shelters because they don't, there just isn't an adequate supply of housing. So really using some of this money for supported housing type services would really help free up other higher end residential services, because we'd be able to move people more quickly through that. I think the other important thing to remember is that if you've got somebody in supported housing and you're wrapping services around them, that really costs about 10% of what per month of what it would cost to have them in a secure residential setting. So I think there's some significant cost savings in terms of treatment dollars as well if we go this route. It's also important because you can really scale this. You can scale supported housing based on the need in, for instance, a rural community in eastern Oregon that may not be able to support a larger licensed residential setting, but could use supported housing and then could provide wraparound services to support people in that housing. So we very much support passage of this bill and creation of this type of fund for all of those reasons.
It's a great idea. It really is. Of course, the Ways and Means process has their prioritization list, but I think it's a wonderful concept. I don't think anyone would disagree with that, and we'll just have to wait and see. Thank you so much for coming and sharing this with us. It's very important for the committee. All right, colleagues, that's all that we have on our agenda. On Tuesday, we just have a few bills also with an informational hearing on the senior disability and mental health and addictions legislative work group that we had. So, colleagues, we're adjourned.